Make me sound pretty.
Make me sound pretty.
Make me sound pretty.
I don't know, man. They're all empty shits.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm a cat face man. I got a cat face for a man.
Meow.
You silly man.
Welcome to Skate Chats, episode 25. I'm Alan, and I'm here with the poor substitute for Beersian Alloy himself, Magellan. This week, we're covering season 3, episodes 3 and 4, collectively known as Self-Inflicted Wounds. Part 1 is subtitled, Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda, and it was written by David Kemper, directed by Tony Tills, and it aired March 30th, 2001, in the United States. Hi, Magellan. I had to do. I like doing that. That's a. I was trying to pick a good quote from this episode, and then I was just going to call you that without telling you.
It's very humbling. What a farscape.
Ooh, yes, what a farscape. Nice. I thought Self-Inflicted Wounds as a two-parter was fantastic, and I think that Farscape actually, just to get into it, really thrives when it has this two-episode time to flush out themes and emotional weight. Because this is a very heavy pair of episodes. And they dealt with very different things, too, which I thought was neat. Because, you know, we look back at the Princess trilogy, and I feel like that episode, or that trilogy of episodes, rather, felt kind of drawn out because the second part was a lot of getting places. But when you have a two-parter, you have the time to say everything you want to say, but not too much time that you're spinning your wheels at any point, just to kind of reference the second episode also. So I thought, yeah, Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda in particular was a really great episode. I think I liked the second one more, but the first one deals with some very cool stuff. And, you know, we talked last week about how it feels like the show is trying to get to a different level of emotional weight with its sort of problem of the week episodes. And I feel like this episode is actually a good direction for them to be heading. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely like the tonal shift, or not shift, but kind of the tonal cementation that is happening in this pair of episodes. And I also think that both of these episodes are a great testament to the fact that continuity does wonders for Farscape. Oh, yeah. Continuity is what this show needs and what really makes it pop. Some shows, I think, can get by on kind of like thing of the week, and that works. But with this episode, you know, we have several relationship arcs that are carrying over from the first two episodes of the season, or even carrying over from last season in a way that enriches this episode and gives it something to do. So I think that that's great. And then also, we'll talk about the second episode when we talk about it, but, you know, it also presents implications for further future continuity that are going to shape the way the show is going forward. So just this idea that episodes can have the space to change the way that the show is and sort things out over a long period of time, I think is a much better state for Farscape to be in.
Yeah, and that point about continuity, I really started noticing partway through these episodes. And just like, for example, the way that Crichton speaks and channels his problems through the Harvey remnant that's still in his head feels like the kind of thing that you can't show someone unless they're really familiar with what's going on in Farscape. And you have to be caught up, and there's references to Zahn's actions in season one and Chiana's history with Dargo going back from the moment that they met. All of these really complex webs of continuity, like you said, that are really, they really enrich the episode. And it feels like there's a lot of subtext that doesn't need to be said in this episode. Because, again, especially in part one, I felt like there was a lot of weight being given to silence. But I think what's an important thing to do to sort of suss out what was happening in these episodes is I'm going to read this sort of paragraph summary of part one, Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda, from the Farscape Illustrated Companion for season three. Because there's a lot, the A-plot in this episode, while very interesting and while very heavy, again, I'm going to be using that word a lot this week, is pretty weird, and it takes a little bit of time to wrap your head around.
That's a marker of a Kemper script.
Very true, very true. While Dargo is still reeling from the shock of discovering Chiana and Jothi's treachery, the crew head for a suitable planet on which to plant the ailing Zahn. However, before they reach their destination, Pilot discovers a wormhole, and Crichton excitedly insists that they investigate it. Before he can begin, another ship emerges, colliding and fusing with Moya. Both ships are trapped within the wall of the wormhole between the passage and real space. Once again, the Leviathan is seriously injured, and while Crichton and the alien leader Pathfinder Niala try to understand what has happened, the other crew members, now including the disoriented Interion, Jewel, are desperate to keep Moya strong enough to attempt to starburst. Unfortunately, the damage is too severe, and although they all realize that the ships still will need to be separated, only one will survive intact. What did you think of Niala, I guess? Because she's a really fascinating villain.
I thought she was one of the coolest aliens we've seen in a long time.
Why is that? It's her physiology, and it's also the way that her brain works, because a thing that I called her a villain a minute ago, but she's not inherently trying to hurt anyone. She has her own crew's interests in mind, just like they do. So this episode feels like two independent groups with their own plans and goals in mind, and they're being put together in a situation where one of them needs to be
right,
taken out.
It,
that's at least part one. That's kind of the
really
the
calls into
end.
Question this thing that we haven't necessarily been considering much in Farscape since season one, which is the notion of loyalty and who are you responsible to in this kind of world. And Rigel, maybe in the second episode, but Rigel has this crack with Crichton where he says that there isn't any point in like feeling a kinship to Moya's crew or to Moya because they were all thrown together by happenstance and they're just waiting for any opportunity to screw each other over to get what they want, right? And then even Harvey and John's brain is questioning why have loyalty to Moya when it's rationally very clear that she's going to die and there's a lot more benefit, even scientific benefit, that can come out of abandoning her. Yeah, so and then, you know, why, I guess we know that Zahn sacrifices herself. We don't need to pretend like we don't. But kind of why is she doing that? And ultimately, what are the boundaries of being thrown together by chance and being familial, and where does that all lie?
There is a good point to be made, sure, that Rigel is the most realistic out of anyone on the crew, because I think the scene that you're referring to is when him and John are in the Farscape 1 and they're scanning the wormhole for anomalies, and then Rigel realizes, if we just left, we could leave. And he tells Crichton that, and Crichton says, why are you such an asshole, basically? And Rigel says, there is no part of me that is an asshole. And I think it's really important that Crichton doesn't see himself, or excuse me, I don't think there's any point in...
Right.
Rigel doesn't see himself as a bad person. You know, he sees himself as a pragmatic person who knows what he wants and how to get it. And he feels like everyone else is being tied down by questions of loyalty.
There's also the central
of faith,
kind of moral dispute of this pair of episodes, which is that John is becoming blind to the needs of Zahn and Moya because of the proximity of the wormhole and the potential to find a way to return home. So he's feeling this pull that Rigel's identifying as, you know, we all have a place that we want to return to. That's kind of our whole conceit. But the difference between you and me, John, is that I, Rigel, am acknowledging it, and I'm not going to get sentimental about the fact that I want what I want, whereas you are actively ignoring other people's needs and wishes in order to pursue this thing that could potentially get you what you want. So don't try to pretend like you're better than me. Basically, right?
Yeah, you have no higher ground just because you are making the claim that.
But
you
yeah, why don't I have some notes? I took notes.
There
this
is
week.
A lot of different small emotional arcs. Oh, yay! Now go for it. You can do your notes.
Let's
I was just going to start going
go
through
my everyone's
notes, but we haven't heard your notes before.
Great.
So this is exciting.
I appreciated the first line of this episode. It was just like half swears. Something like it was like, where the Hezmata is the Freling,
oh yeah,
Drenning, whatever he said. Yeah. Again, this first scene, great continuity going on where it's Dargo and Aaron and they're talking about the Chiana situation while also dealing with this frozen Interion who is still around from last season's finale. So we're unpacking and unraveling the implications of Daimy Dichotomy and of the first two episodes of this season bit by bit. Like, it was all kind of set, and there's still little pieces that we can keep unpacking as we go.
Speaking of that scene, Dargo ends it, basically, I think Aaron asks him, you know, are you willing to start working to forgive Chiana for all of this stuff? And he hangs. The moment hangs for, like, a couple seconds before he says, I'm not ready. And it is, that's some amazing editing, and also just a great moment from Anthony Simcoe where he's really willing to be like, his whole thing in this episode is he knows he has the potential to forgive Chiana and to move on. And it's not the worst thing in the world. Like, we know we can get past this, but there's a fundamental part of my core that says, no, why would you forgive someone for doing this? That doesn't make sense. So he has this, like, clashing of two ideals in his head that he just can't consolidate.
And it's again, really, that question of really loyalty and whole family, right? Because it's somebody that he's felt bound to for such a long time. Bound to falling in love. Uh-huh, honey. Somebody that he's felt bound to for a long time. Bound to falling in love. and who he's felt familial ties to, somebody who he wanted to welcome into his family, right? But now, with this betrayal, there's the question of, does he repudiate, does he punish that betrayal, or does he forgive it and honor the loyalty that he had invested in her for so long? So that's kind of Dargo's angle on this loyalty question that's overriding this two-episode arc.
It's also a smart choice of them to put Pilot out of commission for a lot of this episode, because I feel like Pilot would have been a very neutral core for a lot of people to bounce their ideas off of. And he's very quickly in episode one slowly taken, or, you know, very quickly taken out. And then by episode two is completely knocked out by the problems going on within Moya. He vomits Nickelodeon slime at Stark at one point, which is a cute moment, but kind
of
gross.
And then he has like the
there's
little,
a lot of fun trivia about
like milk
that.
Mustache of puke on his face.
Yep.
He's
like, oh, I'm so sick.
It was cartoonish almost.
But over time, he's just eventually knocked out, and we don't see Pilot do anything until the very end when he comes in to kind of help save the day.
Yeah, but I have that's just
Pilot.
One.
And then
just
I want to talk about Stark
one
in
more
this episode,
Pilot
any
comment
of these pairs.
Before we go there, which is that Pilot this season has seemed either like consistently angrier or constipated. Like a lot of it wasn't the case at the end of the second episode, but at the beginning of this first episode, a lot of Pilot's line deliveries were like, I'm trying to do this. Commander Crichton, I'm
I was thinking a lot about Lonnie Tupu's delivery in these episodes, because Pilot is, I think the reason for that is because he's spending so much of the episode being, like, when Moya is being hurt, we get that type of delivery from Pilot, you know? So when the episodes tend to focus on Moya, Pilot is just the proxy for how does the ship feel. So when Moya is being hurt, Pilot just feels angry and sassy.
And there's
like
some
shit his pants
frustration
constantly.
On Pilot's part, I'm sure, at the beginning of, we want to get somewhere where Zahn can be planted, and oh look, there's a wormhole, and listen to me, there's somebody coming. So there's kind of some difficulty on his part with communicating with John, but I just find it interesting that we've seen a much angrier Pilot over the last few episodes for various reasons. Moya was hurt and they had to go to the Diagnosian. They had to, or after Aaron's death, he was a lot more frustrated with the way that things were going. So more emotional dimension to Pilot, and I'm curious to see if that continues.
Yeah, I do hope so, because I think, you know, now that we're losing characters, it's good to... true. Well, it means that we need to flesh out the characters that have been here for so long, and they need more to do than just be... Like, Pilot can't just at this point still be the Pilot. And the proxy for Moya, he also needs to have some sort of agency.
What if the Diagnosian sang Bound 2?
Stake in things. That's just me singing that. That's not even...
Let's do it.
Let's talk about Stark. I think that Stark and Zahn's relationship feels very classical. Almost like kind of Shakespearean, or at least that's what they're going for. Because it's very much like bad boy with a shitty past meets terminally ill woman. And I feel like that gains dimension over these two episodes, and the way that he cares about her because she is his other half. She is the soft, caring for others part that contrasts Stark's very much like active,
There's something deeply like operatic about the emotions, their emotions in that relationship. Especially Stark is very, it's almost theatrical, and his mask kind of for some reason recalls for me like a fan of the opera. Specifically, but just in general, stage masks and kind of like classic stage archetypes and sort of how they interact. So I think that's an interesting point, saying classical, because there's definitely something deeply archetypical about what they have going on and how it's expressed through costumes and through their performance.
That mask stuff is clearly intentional on the part of the writers and the way that he uses that other half of him. Because he's clearly a man split by two ideals. Like, he wants to be the good person that can be on a crew, but he also wants to, you know, get the revenge for the people who have died of his people, like, of his people. And, he has wants. And, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how Stark feels like he doesn't have a place on the ship yet. But especially considering that Rigel, at this point, has been, like, mostly antagonistic to the rest of the crew, I feel like Stark is, in his relationship to Zahn, establishing a firm place on the crew other thing that I'm starting to really get
into. You talk
about
him split between two halves, is that second half is something that he's trying to repress or conceal, right? So that the image in the mask is covering half of the face. And he has that monologue to Zahn when he's desperately talking about how badly he needs to find a place to plant her, that he's like filled with evil and he's tried to repress it, but like this evil has grown inside of him. And I don't remember exactly how it goes, but it's actually a really well-written monologue on his part, talking about this kind of deep evil inside of him. So I'm curious, because you saying that like his relationship to Zahn is grounding him to the ship is true, but in the wake of her death, where does he go and what becomes of this evil that he's speaking of?
That's such a good point, because and that's why I'm curious to see where the show takes him from here on out, because, you know, he has that moment in the second episode that we'll get to where he yells at Jewel, and that very much feels like the bad half of Stark is just coming out now. The part that is angry and desperate, but he's starting to, like, reconcile it with his good half and starting to, like, blend the two. But we'll get to that. I think that conversation is worth digging into. There's a lot of good Dargo Shiana dialogue back and forth. He kind of Banjo-Kazooie's her at one point and just starts putting her on his
back. I would say he
kind
of C-3PO Chewbacca's her.
Oh, that's actually... it really says a lot about where our pop culture backgrounds come from. Then you pulled Star Wars and I pulled that game. Well, he puts her on her back on his back because she's hurt. And it's enough of like, I don't want to help you. I don't want to be... I'm not ready to like be 100% nice with you, but I'm willing to carry you, which is actually like a very Dargo move. Because it still feels like he, although they are physically closer, he's like maintaining an emotional distance for a little while at least. And as she kind of begs for him to forgive her in one of the first scenes where everything's going wrong, it feels weirdly inappropriate because he's being told by like Aaron's son, like, oh, you need to do something on the ship and repair this thing. And then she comes in and she's like, what can I do? And he's like, you need to do this, and this.
Whoa.
And she's like, no, what can I do about us? And you're like, wow, really? Now? Okay, I guess we're talking about this. And that scene goes wherever, but then it ends with her saying, I'm kind of in the mood to be destructive, which is so like, all right, fuck it. If I can't make you forgive me, then I'm going to blow something up right now.
I maybe overemphasize the point that Farscape cuts to the chase quite well, but I just can't help but envision another show where like there's a scene where Chiana's like, no, what can I do about us? And then Dargo walks past her and then she like turns her head, whips her head around and like cries and then that keeps happening.
She's like, oh,
when that scene happened, I was appreciative of the fact that she was showing remorse and that they're, you know, that they were handling and addressing and broaching the issues of that relationship. But I was a little worried that would kind of become Chiana's character role for a while. The like, oh, Dargo, I'm so sorry thing, which I can understand a character doing that, but I just hope that like we can separate Dargo and Chiana from each other a little more so that they can have relationships with other characters. Because Dargo gets to have meaningful interactions with Aaron and with John in this episode. And the Aaron-Dargo relationship is one that we haven't seen on screen a ton in a while, so it was nice to get that opening scene and to refresh that. So I'm just hoping that Chiana kind of gets that same amount of attention with respect to her interactions with other characters.
She does deserve better than that. And she even has the moment where she pushes back against this whole like feeling sad thing, and he says like, why did you do what you did? And she's like, you put me into a corner, I do terrible things, I'm sorry, and I want you to forgive me, but I need you to also understand where I was coming from.
Either I'm just saying that I The romantic dimension of a character is one of many dimensions. And so Dargo and Chiana can have this relationship Chiana is remorseful, but that doesn't mean that she has to only be the character who is remorseful to Dargo. She can also be the character that has, you know, this kind of relationship with John Crichton, and this relationship with Aaron, and this relationship with Stark, and this with whoever, with Jewel. Like, well, maybe they'll become best friends. No. But yeah.
Not in this episode.
In that, something I forgot to mention, a line that I liked in the Aaron-Dargo scene at the beginning. Dargo says, "We're all destroyed, Aaron. Mm-hmm. It's just that some of us don't know it yet." Smash cut to Stark. "Wow, no, I'm crying. Yes. My man crying." Stark's pretty sexy, right?
He cries, yeah. That's...
Like, you can tell he's...
I think that Stark's cute.
No, but you...
I'm not a big fan of the ball. You can tell
he's a little handsome man.
You're talking about the actor, probably? Yeah, totally. You see any pictures of Paul Goddard online, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. But speaking of Jewel, who you mentioned earlier, she's introduced in this episode in an amazing scene featuring maybe my favorite line of the whole duology. Like, that's not
the whole two episodes. How about that?
Duology is a good word, though. I don't
know. The whole arc, I don't know.
The whole two episodes. Crichton opens up the... Oh, no, duology is the word I'm looking for.
It's just kind of a uselessly small word.
He opens up the... That's true. He opens up the pod that has her inside of it, and she comes out, and he says, "Hey, Sleeping Beauty, wake up and die."
Okay, so why did he wake her up? Oh, it was?
Because it was already opening? Like, the thing was opening?
Because I think there... It was opening, but there was also the hope on John Crichton's part that she would know something about where Earth is or how to get there in relation to the wormhole stuff that was going on, because her physiognomy was so close to that of humans, so that they must be related.
Oh, right, yeah. And I think the fact that she is human-like is really important for John, because he, you know, his relationship with Aaron is sort of getting so taut at this point because of the whole her being resurrected, and their dynamic has changed again.
Physiognomy for him and physiology. Human and Sebastian physiognomy is similar, which is interesting. Like the way your features...
What does physiognomy mean?
Outer features.
Oh, and the physiology means like body. The pieces inside? Okay. So what do you think of Jewel so far? Because I already kind of like her and how she fits into the role of being on the ship, but I know that a lot of people online kind of see her as the cousin Oliver of the group, because she very much clashes with everyone, with her personality.
Yeah, I think that it's hard to say at this point because she hasn't quite yet meshed into the crew, but even from the beginning, it's hard to figure out why she would, which I guess makes sense because that's where all of these characters originate, though at this point they've gone through enough together that you can kind of expect them to stick together. Whereas with Jewel, she's kind of just here and it's hard to know what to make of her yet. There's a post that was on the Farscape subreddit recently that you mentioned to me, by recently I mean about a month ago, that is kind of the source, I guess, of our impression of what people think of Jewel. And it's a post, I don't know if I want to necessarily read the title of it or not, but it basically is like vaguely sexist and just expresses that this person found her annoying. But then a lot of the comments are kind of like, "I didn't like her either, but then she grew on me," or "I kind of felt bad for her and then I liked her and then I thought she was great." So I think there is some contention over Jewel and over what her value is in the show.
I didn't get to read the comments for that because I didn't want to get spoiled or anything, but it really does make perfect sense that at least there's some group out there who's like, she's, you know, shrill and annoying and she just bothers everyone, because I feel like that right now is the point. Because what I'm getting at in terms of how her role is going to become important is that she is the first character to join Team Moya who's coming from a place of privilege and not coming from a place of fallen grace.
Yeah.
Because they're all a group of prisoners. They're all a group of former prisoners. And she's coming from a place where she's clearly comes from money, clearly comes from success and happiness. And she's like, "I was on a whirlwind tour of all these different planets, and then I got fucked over, and now all of my family is dead." Like, that character directly contrasts with everyone else, especially in this episode where they talk about how we here on Team Moya are very much like a family, and we care about each other because we are all that we have. Whereas she's like, "I don't know any of you. I don't know why I need to care about any of you."
I think that's a fantastic point, because even Chiana, who you could argue is the most recent addition to Team Moya, was herself a former prisoner, just a prisoner of a different group. Jothi was a prisoner. There's just a lot of prisoner-ness in the crew, and it is refreshing to kind of have a different character. I think part of the... The word shrill, obviously, is a problematic word to apply to a female character, and people right. using it, again, is a little... Yeah, it's just not a great word to use. But it's coming from, at least in practical terms, the fact that she, like, screams. Like, screaming is a key part of her character. It's like a power she... Yeah, it's like her power is
and a part
scream.
Of the plot in this episode.
So I can imagine that, at least on, like... an auditory level getting annoying. I think that was my issue with Jewel, is that it seemed like her role in these episodes was at first to like be in the background, and then when she wasn't, her role was to be incompetent at things or not know things, and then to scream.
I would almost argue, and I don't know if the creators were going for this, but I felt like a lot of her character details felt like they were almost a parody of that type of character, in terms of like they're added at a really inopportune moment to the crew, and they're very like, you know, the word shrill gets used a lot with that type of character, the like weird new girl character that gets added to a show, and like her being like very emotionally vulnerable and being kind of like broken down and scared easily, like all of that stuff just feels like the that archetype of character, they're just like taking that to the extreme. Even the fact that her hair color changes when she feels different emotions, it's just like a very feminine thing of they're just like, she's the annoying girl. And whether or not they're doing that to be subversive.
That's an interesting idea. I think I would have to see more of Jewel to comment on that. But I could see it argued both ways, symbolically, why screaming is a power that she has. Because on the one hand, you could say, you know, these kind of characters are relegated to just being able to scream in terror. And that is a position that is kind of robbing them of some sort of situational agency. And so in order to re-empower these characters, we're going to make that scream vital and effective. So on the one hand, there's that positive reading, but then there's the negative reading of you're still creating a character who screams when she's scared and is still limited to that kind of engagement with the situation. Like her only way to respond is to be fearful. And you could have that fear have some kind of a positive practical benefit, but you're still creating a character who is restricted in her emotional range and in the range with which she can express situational power and efficacy. So I think it's an interesting question that we have to watch more to really determine.
Right. We're going to put a tab on Jewel. In terms of what we think about her for now,
yeah.
But she's in it for the long haul, so
and
we'll
hey, cool,
have way more to see.
Real cool costume,
her.
Real cool.
But getting
forehead,
you know, she does have a weird like bent that like weird line in the forehead, and yeah, and her costume is a little over sexualized. But I don't know, maybe that's intentional. Getting back to the thing that we were talking about, I like also just a small character detail that this show does a lot. There are a lot of characters if you look at the cast list. Who have really long names that are shortened to something so that everyone can refer to them. Because her full name is actually Jelushko Tunai Fenta Hovalis. I might be pronouncing that wrong. But they're like, oh, our Rigel says, like, what does everyone else call you? And she's like, my full name. Yeah. And
I think that,
very Jewel.
That was a conscious moment of
like,
kind of
we can't do that. Yeah, yeah. Where, or at least of the show being like, oh, what's your name? Oh, yeah, it's just Jewel. All right, cool. We can just call you that forever. And yeah, Tamia McIntosh, also an interesting actress. She's got a lot of roles under her belt. So I'm interested to see how her performance changes, especially now that there's no more Zahn, sad face, to kind of have her ping off of as like the opposites. She's the like young naive one, and then Zahn was like mom.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty
and now
big
without mom, what are
loss
we
in terms of developing this character specifically.
How is she going
maybe
to develop without the character that can directly... Yeah.
Chiana into a... Well, it might force other characters
force
to
like grow up a
themselves
bit.
With respect to her. So, like, someone like Chiana may have to adopt a more mature approach. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? Stark immediately realizes, like, oh, wait, Zahn might die. I need a new crush. And then he, like, has that awful, awful scene where he breathes on Eren's neck. And then she just, like, immediately shuts him the fuck down. And she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, you're very beautiful. And she's like, so is Zahn. She's not dead yet. get the fuck out of here. Also, even if she was dead, don't touch me. You're like, oh, Aaron's son is taking zero shit ever, even after coming back to, especially after coming back to life, she's not taking any shit. We got Rigel causing just a lot of really raw open drama between Jewel and Chiana, where he just like outs everything about Chiana's past to Jewel and just makes them hate each other even more. He's like, you know, she, if you think she's a whore, then also she had a guy friend who she was going to marry, but she didn't want to marry. And then she slept with his son. Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird? Bye. And then he just like hovers away. You're like, Rigel, you fuck. You absolute fuck. And then they just bicker at each other.
I am a domina.
Rigel's an asshole. And then Zahn's like, do you think you'll be a domina again? He's like, I am a domina. I always will be. Then we kind of get into the back end of this episode. There's that scene with Rigel and John on the Farscape 1 where they try to escape.
Yeah, John beats the shit out of him.
For such a small set. It looked like he was going to try and kill him. So, it's just like, Rigel might
die. It's a question of, is John still a little bit unhinged?
Absolutely. And as we learned throughout this episode, like, the Harvey remnant is still in there, so we don't know if all of his anger and desire to leave is, like, coming from himself being frustrated, or if it's also from this thing that's still in his head. Like,
you ain't so many gotta know, Guido. You of got John slits.
That line I wrote down, because, it's funny that, of course, John watches SNL and references Guido Sarducci, but also, I was just thinking earlier in the episode about Rigel's nose, and then Rigel spends the rest of this episode with a bandage on his nose, and then just takes it off in partway through episode two.
I just a lot of emotional weight out of silence. Lines I was gonna just read out. This is just from over the course of this episode. One from Dargo saying, "I'm angry with myself because I can almost forgive her about Chiana." That's a nice line. There's an exchange between, I think this is between Aaron and Dargo, where one of them says, "I think wormholes blind him," talking about John Crichton, and the other says, "Well, at least he has a hobby." That's fun. Mm-hmm. That's a good line. And then the last one I have here is a really strong line from Rigel, which is, "You know what you and Pilot have in common besides big eyes?" Saying to Zahn, "You're both dying."
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. Laying it all out there.
Yeah, yeah. I like that that way that they can like kind of pair characters up together. Again, it's just the Whedon test being utilized. But like, I think it's in part two where Zahn kind of like lays out the plan of like, "Hey, Aaron, here's how you and I are basically exactly the same." Yeah. I can find that line later when we talk about it. But like, yeah, Zahn, and especially in these two episodes, spends a lot of time like reminding people why they are together and why they're on the ship. And why they should work together instead of be in conflict. And then there's a John Harvey scene in this episode, which I really loved. I can't remember which one it was in this episode.
I think there was this a couple, especially here at the drive-through.
Yes, and Crichton's wearing the like button-up shirt, and he's like, "Hey, Scorpius is probably alive, right?" And then Harvey doesn't answer, and then he's like, "No, yeah, he's totally alive, and he's probably working on a new research facility." And Crichton's like, "Well, shit, that's not cool." But yeah, they also kind of they have these like little moral plays where they're talking about the current situation and being like, "Hey, how are you planning to handle this, Crichton?" Like, this version of Harvey is very accommodating because he has to be, you know? He's in Crichton's head and he's not, like, the changing of the control between the two of them leads to a lot of different dynamics that you didn't see when it was, like, Scorpius was all the way in control. Because now Harvey can, like, has to sit down in the car and can't get out, like, physically. And Crichton can leave the space of his mind whenever he really wants to. So it's really neat to see that. And I think this type of scene is going to become very common for at least the next couple of episodes because that remnant is going to be in there for a while. And I really like it. I really like how it develops John's. It's a way for John to suss out the like, show moral problems in his head.
To pose moral problems of its own and to kind of convey a range of opinions on different things because the crew themselves can disagree a lot. And so we can have these sorts of moral conundrums even with just members of the crew. But Scorpius or Harvey offers a perspective that nobody else is going to offer. Even Rigel's so-called practicality is still couched in the idea of we're all greedy. But the Harvey's notion of practicality isn't from a standpoint of greed. It's from a standpoint of objective utility, like what's going to get the most done. And so in that sense, it is disturbing in a way that Rigel's viewpoint isn't necessarily, because Rigel's you can kind of write off as greed, and you can also envision a scenario in which Rigel's objections kind of drop away. Like if we shift our loyalty from the thing that we want to the place that we are than the Rigel notion of I want a certain thing and that's going to interfere with how this works, that falls away because you can redefine what you are greedy for. And you can also find a way to orient people's greed in a manner that's mutually beneficial. But when it comes to, like, it would be better for science to get this wormhole technology than to cling to a dying ship, that is a viewpoint that is not going to just change with changing values. That has a kind of abstract absolutism to it that I think is going to be consistently challenging and very interesting.
Because Rigel, not only is he the greedy one and his loyalties can shift based on how his greed manifests itself, but Harvey is not
right.
physically real.
Right.
So he has no stake in his own self-preservation. He exists only to think about things. Like, if John dies, that's just like, all right, well, the Harvey remnant is gone. Scorpius is still alive. Like, he has no reason to, he has no goal at all other than to just exist. At least that's what it seems like right now. And to be utilitarian. And whereas Rigel has these goals and has his own life at stake.
Yeah, he has nothing at stake in convincing John that he's right. Like, he can just hold a view and express it without
needing
to
things.
Go through any kind of rhetorical hoops, which is something that he did have to do when he was trying to accomplish the express goal of getting John to Scorpius.
Right. I really, the dynamic between Harvey and John is so fascinating. Yeah. And it leads to them getting to do a lot of great sets on Earth, you know, like that drive-in movie theater, and John gets to wear like a nice different outfit, and Wayne Pigram gets to play a very, very, very different kind of Harvey. It's all over the place, and I'm it's one of the things where you see, like, this could probably go on for the rest of the show, and I would be totally fine with that. I think it's a really efficient and good way to help John figure some stuff out. Do you have any particular notes that for scenes that we've skipped over? Because I have some notes that are kind of about the aliens,
the Niala and co, but we can save those for the second episode discussion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Basically, the second half of the episode is a lot of discussion of, like, hey, Moya's already dying for whatever reason, probably because we've already collided. And the other ship has wormhole technology on it, and we are allowed to be on the other ship. They're going to let us just stay on that one, and then they're going to let us, you know, they're going to drop us off at the nearest gas station, and we're going to figure things out. Like, they really, the smart thing about this episode is that it really does seriously consider the possibility that maybe we're just going to have to drop Moya off, because the stakes have immediately risen to life or death, and we no longer have the option of trying to save things, so we just have to seriously consider cutting our losses and moving on, and we're going to lose Pilot, and we're going to lose Moya, but that's life. It's very adult series of decisions that they have to make, because there's no winning, obviously, at least in the first episode. That's why I was saying that these two felt like very different in the kind of questions that they're tackling, because you could argue that the them deciding to sacrifice Moya because she's already going to die is very, very similar to the stuff that happened in Dime Dichotomy, and the question of, like, these bodies that are frozen are already going to die, is it worth, should we like take their parts out for science? And, like, should we keep the other ship because it has wormhole technology? Like, those questions are very clearly pulling from the same philosophical core. But that question kind of gets answered in the second episode. Jewel tries to kill Crichton at one point because she finds out that all of her cousins are dead. And I guess she presumes it was his
one
fault.
One of them, yeah.
Or it was his fault because they were used to... She hates Tiana a lot. And,
sorry
Niala
to cut you off, but I love
has
that
a bunch of
Jewel's... The guy that John got brain fluid from had like 16 PhDs or something. That's so funny.
Oh yeah, she's like, yeah, he was very worldly, he had all of his PhDs, and yeah, he's like incredibly smart and was worth keeping alive. Like, he had big plans for the world. Dargo tongues her to stop her from killing John, though. She has that dumb moment where she tries to shoot him, and he's like, what are you gonna do with that? Boom. Oh my god, are you gonna try and kill me?
Hey, stop that.
Why would you do that? But that, yay, don't, please don't do that. And then that really just leads to the scene where Dargo's like, oh, there's a hole in this force field. Huh. Which I don't fully get how they paid that off. Is that a second episode?
So
kind of
in
thing?
The second episode, John uses that knowledge. They're being chased by that worm thing. And then he and right.
Yep.
And then he and the Aaron go into that little shuttle, and he turns on the force field to cut it in half. But I wasn't sure what that shuttle was why it mattered that we could get into it.
Yeah, they made a big deal out of it. I think they wanted to get into it because it had the force field. I think John didn't know why. He was like, Dargo said this was a good idea. But it just led to them doing that thing where, yeah, you could cut the mythical worm with the force field. I also think it's a kind of cool horror movie thing where the worm at first is just a thing that Zahn says, like, someday I'm going to be killed and my death is going to involve a worm. And they're like, that's weird. It's not real. And she's like, I saw it. And then they're like, that's not real. And then they see it and they're like, oh, shit. This is just a real worm.
Yeah.
A real pretty good CG worm, actually. Like, not terrible. We get a lot of Niala talking to her crew, including Shrina, and talking about how she doesn't want to send these younglings to her death, but plays a guilt trip about her family. And they have a true mission that they mention, which we learn about in the second episode. And all of the panels are checking out on Moya, and they're not working anymore. And Moya's just dying slowly. And basically, Niala and company, with the people of amongst them who are still alive, say like, hey, yeah, we're going to have to pick one of these ships. And we're going to bounce. Basically, the way I kind of visually understood it in my head was one of these is going to have to be the base. And the other one is going to jump off of it out of the water slide that we're sliding through. And then we're going to be able to bounce out together. But one of them has to be left here, and it's going to float forever and not exist. And they're like, I guess, mate, at the very end of this first episode, they're like, I guess we should choose the science ship. And you're like, oh, no, Moya's going to die. But it's a part one, so what? And then this episode ends with one of the best
scenes.
Remind
me what it was.
With one of the best scenes. So first of all, you have Crichton sitting, very clearly paralleling that scene from one of the older episodes from like season one, where him and Aaron were under pilot. And he was kind of like cradling her in his arms. And they had this like cute romantic moment, which we talk about sometimes. But now he's sitting by himself and he's looking at the dimension kaleidoscope, which is just like a bunch of pointy tubes coming out of a circle. And he looks inside and he's just watching all of the dimensions flip by, which I would love to have a device that does that. Even if you're only seeing like a split second of each dimension, like imagine what it's like to see, just be able to see all of the worlds appear in front of you for a brief second. That's like so cool to me. And he's doing that, and he's just kind of getting engrossed in it. And he's like, ah, none of these look like Earth. I guess I'm screwed. And then he just real briefly flashes to a scene from The Three Stooges. And he goes, wait a minute. And it, like, kind of slows down. And then he just stops on that one. And it's a scene of, like, two of the Stooges beating up on, I think, Curly. And that's kind of, like, the note that it's going to end on. And you're like, oh, holy shit. And then the dimension worm comes in. Snips at his legs or something, and then like tries to, it looks like he's gonna die. That again, good trivia about that thing that I'll read. But that was the episode. Do you have anything else you wanted to say about the episode before we get into background info?
Great.
Okay, then Len, let's read the background info, starting
I got
with
some stuff for you.
The Farscape
Crace does not appear in this episode. Yeah,
what I mean,
the original the run too far in love.
Bound to
the original idea for this episode came up in 1998 when Rocknius O'Bannon and David Kemper were brainstorming story ideas. So this is one of their first little ideas.
Yeah, I was reading the genesis of this episode was a lot of them being like, we want a dimension worm. This like these two episodes were pulling from a lot of different small story ideas that they had, and they're like, let's just squish them into what you can kind of tell. Like the dimension worm feels like one thing, the Niala stuff is another thing, and then the Zahn stuff is a third.
In her shortened role in the third season, Virginia Hay wore a bald cap, while in previous seasons she had shaved her head. It looks fine. She could have just been wearing a bald cap this whole time.
They mentioned that. Yeah, once they realized that they were probably going to have to write her out of the show, they were like, let's let her grow her hair back. And then if she's okay with the makeup and with having the bald cap, then we'll keep her on. But she
That's
still wasn't
bad.
Okay with the makeup. So they were like,
according to Paul Goddard, pilot's puke was tastier than it looked and was not as revolting as it appeared on screen. It's probably just sugar. Oh,
probably.
Okay.
Or I think it was like carrot juice.
Jewel's hair was designed to change colors with her mood. Blonde was when calm, vivid red when excited. So I guess, yeah, you figured it out.
I like that they didn't have to say
before
that.
Before deciding on the Three Stooges, other possibilities for the Earth transmission were I Love Lucy, Mr. Ed, and the Marx Brothers. That same like class of old thing.
Do you want me to read real quickly why they chose that specific scene from the Three Stooges? The writers felt it was the right time for Crichton to be reminded of home. Everyone jumped in with ideas for what it was going to be. Kemper remembers, I Love Lucy, Mr. Ed, the Marx Brothers. Finally, I said it had to be the Three Stooges. I wanted a specific clip where they're all together and Curly gets abused, because I knew that Scorpius was going to ask Crichton why it is always the innocent that bear the brunt of our dreams and ambitions.
Yeah.
So that was incredibly intentional. Like, even the moment that they chose was intentional. I thought that
and
was
such an amazing
really smart of
springboard
them.
Into a line that kind of sums it all up. Yeah, just really, really resonant and that we'll talk about. The wormhole snake was created by CG by Animal Logic. The original plans to have Jim Henson's Creature Shop create a snake head for close-ups were dropped during filming. Okay. The script for the episode suggested that the Pathfinder vessel was about 1/20th the size of Moya. So, and it looked kind of small in the space shots.
Yeah. Huh.
There's a landmass in
the
shape of the
vessel?
Continental
yeah.
United States on the planet Zahn sees fly by as she's looking out the window, I guess. Yeah. There you go.
That's cute. Mm-hmm. That was coulda, woulda, shoulda. And I thought that was a really fun discussion. Let's take a quick break and then come back to talk about Wait for the Wheel. Hello, crew members. This is Alan bringing you the Moya Bag for episode 25 of Scape Chats, where we read your feedback and comment on it. First up, we got a big old long memo from... Oldest Year Omens. Who says, right, you nerds, let's talk about Season of Death, because I like this one, and next to a few clunkers, it only gets better. I can't help but contrast the previous finale and opener with our future finale and opener. In the Season 3 finale, we're left to stew for a bit, 5 long agonizing episodes. I got through 4 and skipped the last one, so be careful what you wish for is what I'm saying. Scorpio episodes become kind of a thing, the biggest one being Incubator, but also Into the Lion's Den and quite a bit of Season 4. And since we're splitting time this season a lot, we're going to be working in some very innovative territory. I erased Joffy from my memory the second this episode ended. He's a parasite on my mind, you'll only see him once again, thank God. The new theme is home. It is my home. It has nestled into my heart. And it is beautiful. And when I hear it, I'm there. I love hate the scene where Grunchlick eats his finger. Again, appreciating the not violence reveling. I don't own the Season 3 Illustrated Companion. I never paid attention to Unity thing before, but I kind of want to know how that's interesting. I'll break there and respond to that part right now because I responded to Omens on Twitter and now I need to find the piece from the Illustrated Companion. Here it is. Regarding why her saying Unity thing was kind of an intentional, cool decision. Claudia Black feels that Eren had a problem accepting what Zahn had done to her. When she actually comes out of the pod, she fires at the two soldiers who are threatening Zahn and Stark, but she doesn't acknowledge what Zahn's done. She looks at her, and there's an ambiguous moment where she doesn't acknowledge her verbally at all, and just asks her where the others are. She wants to avoid the emotion. She can't quite come to grips with Zahn's spiritual world. I suggest that it was much more appropriate for Eren to say that Zahn did a Unity thing, rather than say she did Unity with me. I don't actually know who to attribute that quote to. I believe it's the writer of the episode. But yeah, even little lines like that are clearly super intentional, and I love that about this show. Moving on to their comments about Sons and Lovers. Fine, decent, fine, couldn't finish it again, fine. Farscape does jerk you around with Jon and Eren a little bit, especially at the end of the season and the beginning of the next one, but it's a good jerk around. It's a jerk around that rips out your heart and stomps on it, and you don't feel like you're being jerked around while it's happening. But then it gets dumb because, and then they kind of talk about all that stuff. Societal commentary episodes on Farscape are subtle, and they do get better. All I can say is it does get better, which I'm confident in. Daycare center, kids, Mama Baron, religious chick, no more meat to that. I watched the episode in the hospital, and I was happy for something easy and distracting at the time, but it's very boring. That shot, with Jon being framed between Eren's legs before she falls through the door, Eren being masculinized, Jon being feminized, all that hits home with the framing and the dialogue as well, with Jon being more reluctant to have sex without love. The episode where Eren discovers a reason to live could kind of be considered the choice, but not really, because it's way, way later and after a different thing. Jalushko something something Yenta Havalis. Bratty, rough around the edges, smart, selfless, sexy, nice. And finally, they agree with Magellan that this Dargo plot was too annoying to get invested in, but also the Union tattoo thing freaked me out. He's angry, it's good, and also bad. Frelmy dead. Thank you, Omens. We didn't get other tweets this week, which is fine, but you can send those if you have tweets to send us at twitter.com/escapechats. Moving on to the Reddit thread, we have a very long comment here from Blue Blaze Spear, one of my favorite frequent commenters, getting into a lot of stuff about the new opening monologue and how it conveys the tone of things that are going to come up later, and how the episode titles clearly became intentional at this point, and a lot of the talk was that PK Tech Girl was one that they lamented not getting to write a more intentional title for. They're not a fan of the episodes of Farscape where they have to deal with space magic, and that's kind of Sons and Lovers. And there's a scene that happens in Season 4 where Rigel basically looks at the audience and says, don't think about these things that don't make sense, just enjoy the ride. And for me, that was like, when I watched Sons and Lovers, it's hard to enjoy the ride when the ride itself isn't even that fun, but the space magic stuff is definitely a big part of that. I'm going to read this part in its entirety. Speaking of Rigel, there is something that I appreciate about his characterization. He manages to grow as a character without fundamentally changing who he is. It's easy to forget that he's lived a long time and has spent 130 of those cycles being imprisoned and or tortured. Since he managed to stay the person that he is all of that time, it'd be pretty weird for him to dramatically change the course of who he is in 4 seasons. Of course we want to see him become a better version of himself, but it probably wouldn't ring true if his personality went through sweeping changes. Something I like about Sons and Lovers is that it's the first time we start to see Moya's crew having a reputation that precedes them, which Maridi agrees with, and then they also asked, or they mentioned, I'm sort of interested in hearing future episodes that include guest commentary. I'm curious to see what the dynamic will be like. Have you guys considered reaching out to any of the cast and crew of Farscape to see if they'd be interested in doing an episode? It might seem like a silly suggestion, but they have a pretty solid history of interacting with fans, and we live in the age of Twitter, where anything is possible. This actually came at a really convenient time because I, just a few days ago, was tweeting at a lot of the people from the Farscape crew, both the actors and writers, asking them if they could, like, plug the show or consider being on. I didn't get a lot of replies, and I also deleted a lot of those posts because I don't want to get more listeners by kind of like forcing our stuff on the people who worked on this show. I want it to be the kind of thing that you can just discover. Although I do like when we get more listeners. But in terms of guest people, I feel like we would be a little too, maybe it would be really difficult and scary to do it with like Rockne S. O'Bannon or someone. But even if it was just like a writer or a second unit director, like I would love to have someone from the Farscape crew. If anyone has any connections and they can help with that, that'd be beyond amazing. Nygmus says, I remember only one thing about Sons and Lovers, and that was Pilot's maniacal laugh as he blew the panel that Kooky Cultist was attached to. It was beautiful, which I wish I could find the audio of that easily, but it's basically just like a ah, ha 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 out of Pilot of all people. And Magellan speaks in this episode about how it seems like Pilot has been consistently angry in the last couple episodes, and that is a very good example where he's just kind of, well, he's happy, like he's glorifying this violence of like, yay, we threw the lady out of the airlock, but it's just like a different type of Pilot that we haven't seen before. Ooh, lots of comments here. Last one, though, that I'm going to read is from Leo Chris, who says, great episode, guys, as always. Sons and Lovers is indeed kind of dud, and I definitely think they lucked out having to let Joffy go. Then again, considering how often the show has just been known to go with it at certain points without planning ahead, especially in regards to actor availability, it's a miracle that the whole thing feels coherent. That's part of the charm of Farscape. And then this next section is in regards to a thing that happened in the episode that we're discussing today. So it's actually after this Moya bag. So I guess for people, everyone who's listening to this has watched the show, so I guess I can read it. I sincerely wonder when they knew for certain that Virginia had to leave. I don't believe they knew in season 2, so this is really illustrating my earlier point. Lucking out in terms of dramatic stakes. Planting Zahn somewhere for a few episodes with no real consequences would have really cheapened season 2's cliffhanger. As it stands, it's less of a dead is cheap cliche and more of an actual sacrifice and a real loss. I'll have a lot more to say next week, though, as Jewel is finally here. This might be, oh, who am I kidding, it is, a minority opinion within the fandom, but I absolutely adore Jewel. Can't wait to see what you guys think of her. You are going to be pleasantly surprised, Leo Chris. At least so far. A couple notes about this episode. You may notice that the sync is a little bit off. Basically, the big reason for that is I had trouble getting the tracks to continue staying synced after a certain point because there was a lot of like cutting from one while there was noise and then muting another one, and I was like playing with new editing techniques. So it's all listenable. I wasn't able to go back and fix it because I have spent like 2 hours on this. It's currently Wednesday afternoon. I don't have a lot of time to go back and like fix all of it, but I believe all of it is listenable. Please excuse it, though, if it feels like it sounds like we are talking over each other a lot, because we're not. We just, the sync is like imperfect. And I like to think it sounds more conversational this way. You can contribute to those Reddit threads over at reddit.com/r/farscape. Send us anonymous asks at scapechats.tumblr.com. We mentioned the Twitter earlier. And that's going to do it for the Moy Bag this week. I think it's time to throw it back to Alan and Magellan for their discussion of the second half of Self-Inflicted Wounds. And we're back. The second part of Self-Inflicted Wounds is subtitled Wait for the Wheel, and it was also written by David Kemper and directed by Tony Tills, but it aired April 6th, 2001. I have less to say about this episode because we got through most of the big stuff in the first part. This song goes on too long.
I'm glad I asked.
Oh, I'm glad you asked. When checking through the data that he and Raja collected during their trip through the wormhole, Crichton discovers a transmission from Earth. But the rest of the crew have little time for this, for they are more concerned with the... This is the same... Oh, no. After Crichton's battle with the wormhole serpent, they find blood on the floor of Pilot's chamber. Zahn identifies it as belonging to the aliens, leading to them to the conclusion that there could be an invisible Pathfinder stalking the ship. The crew realize that Niala clearly hasn't been completely honest with them, and they're being manipulated into abandoning Moya. Confronted, Niala finally admits that her subordinate, Kreetago, is sabotaging the Leviathan. As Dargo and Shiana hunt Kreetago down, Niala's Fastilon generator reaches its optimization phase. There's only one Arn left to save Moya and Pilot, and someone must make the ultimate sacrifice. This is the episode that felt like it was a little bit rushed.
So I didn't get it.
What is there not to get? It's actually it. I also could tell that it was like a little bit complicated, but I kind of get it.
I just don't get why Zahn had to do it.
Someone had to drive the wormhole.
Yeah, but why can't they make that lady do it? Yeah.
Niala? Because she has her own choice. She has her own life to live. She doesn't want to die.
I guess I just didn't understand why one of them had to make a sacrifice, which made it hard for me to feel anything in that moment because it was so complicated.
That's true. The part that made me feel emotional was like when she was kind of talking to everyone. I just knew that she had to go. And it really did feel like they kind of like forced it for practical reasons. They're like, well, shit, all it really means is someone has to stay behind. That is like the simple, I want to understand the
dramatic arc of this episode. Okay, can I read this paragraph that maybe explains it? Okay. Pilot has to initiate starburst 7 microts after the generator is unleashed, and Aaron tells Crichton they don't have to be as close as he thinks, since Moya's weight gives an advantage with the gravitational pull of the wormhole. Pilot gives Crichton manual control, and Crichton wants Aaron to take over. She's reluctant when Zahn says to Crichton, John, no. He says he's got this, and Aaron asks what's going on. Jewel says that someone has to actually trigger the generator, meaning they will be stuck on Niala's ship when it is destroyed. Okay, that makes sense.
Oh, so they just did the opposite of what Niala wanted to do in the first part?
But then where does she end up is the question that I have. She didn't die, right?
No, she's on the ship at the end of the episode, I think. What's
wrong does one of our people have to die, though? Like, what's the difference?
Zahn didn't have anything else going on. She was going to... Oh, no, Crane totally killed Niala.
Okay.
He, like, shoots her or something.
Crichton kicks Niala, and she falls into the generator.
No, because at first it was...
She's vaporized at some point.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. She falls into the warp, and I was like, oh, shit, she's going to warp through infinity. And then
that makes sense.
She's basically dead. But they still had her ship there, and it's like, well, we're just going to get rid of this empty ship. So one of our people has to be on the empty ship.
Okay, yes.
Because there was nobody left from Niala's squad. Now I understand. Yeah. It's a weird inversion of the first episode, where the first one is like us versus them. And this one is very much just like, well, all we got left is us. Mm-hmm. One of us has to go. One of us has to become the them for this plan to work. And Zahn's like, well, I'm already dying. And they're like, we can totally, we're like 2 feet away from a planet. We're so close. And she's like, I don't even know if it's going to work. I've lived a full life. And then we can really just kind of talk about her death scene, because that's the crux of this episode. She tells them, if y'all love me so much and respect me so much because I have good advice for you and because I'm like your sort of like mother figure, then you need to listen to me right now, because I'm telling you a thing as your mother figure right now, which is to get rid of me. And you're like, oh, Zahn, you put me into a corner. I'm so sad. My toes curled up when I heard that scene, because I didn't want to lose Zahn like this, especially again, like you said, because it just felt kind of like she didn't have to die. But I kind of am happy that she went out honorably, I guess. She didn't just like die. She went down fighting.
I think that speech was cool and her assertiveness was cool. I just think that it, like the manner in which she died was a little complex, and it resulted from the fact that they like killed too many people. So I don't know. Like, it just didn't feel viscerally satisfying to me in the way that I wanted it to.
I am totally down for if someone wants to, like, explain in the comments why we're not getting it and why, like, it made more sense to them.
I think I get it now intellectually. Just in the moment, I wasn't, I guess, paying enough attention to the causality of the episode to really get it. You know, that's neither here nor there.
Other than that, though, there is other stuff in this episode, like Kreetago runs around the ship naked and invisible. I think he is naked. I think it's one of those, like, ear clothes.
I don't remember. Wrong, maybe.
Like, ear clothes that don't turn invisible.
You're saying he had to take off his Hot Wheels chassis. their jackets look like Hot Wheels chassis.
Oh, that's true. They actually, I see what you're saying. He'd take it off, and then what are those things that are at the front of a Hot Wheels chassis? They're also in Sonic the Hedgehog, where it's like 4 wheels that spin really, really fast, and when you put a car through them, they go really fast.
Can we just make sure that we both know what the word chassis means? Of a car.
That's like the body of a Hot Wheels thing.
So the front of a car has 4 wheels?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about, I'm just talking about Hot Wheels sets in general.
So the wheel part, the motor, it's like a motor.
The one that goes, yep, that's the one. Yes, it's the thing that makes them go.
Escargo, huh?
It's great. What's the fast... Oh, my God. What's the Fastilon generator? It alters the phase of an object. Yeah. Oh, that's the thing that makes them invisible or something. Or it makes bad man invisible. And then, the scene I really want to talk about in this episode was where Stark yells at Jewel. And that kind of like summarizes the difference between the crew and Jewel, where she's like, oh, my cousins died. I'm on the ship full of assholes and scumbag villains, and I might even just die right away. And he just like becomes the, like we were talking about earlier, the like mean evil Stark, and kind of like, you want to know pain? You want to know suffering? Every single one of us here has had to exist in squalor for months and months or however long, and you have to spend a couple of cycles of sleep after your like worldwide vacation. So like, you know, kind of check your privilege for a second, and here's what real suffering looks like. Here's what real pain looks like. And he takes his mask off, and she does another one of her crazy shrieks.
She complains about having to hold a gun. Not complains. That's an unfair word. She is concerned about holding a gun and keeping Niala prisoner. And Crichton shouts, welcome to the Federation starship SS Buttcrack.
Very petulant of Crichton.
That's a very, very Crichton line. Everything sucks here. Just, welcome to the Federation starship SS Buttcrack.
It's fantastic. Am I the only one who noticed this? Or was this episode in particular like really gorgeous?
Hey, I also noticed it.
Yay! And like the color palettes too. It was specifically, and this is just in general how Farscape looks, but like very high contrast lighting, lots of colored non-natural lighting, like blue and green lights on people, and just like framed really well. Yeah. Like Tony Tillis, you're killing it, my dude. Like this episode felt like the kind where I could just take 1,000 screenshots and make a lot of them like wallpapers and stuff, because they've really mastered the like making the Moya set look diverse and weird and interesting
the
ways.
The other thing, the kind of hallmark really for me of directorial quality in both these episodes was Tony Tillis' ability to make people in different parts of the ship feel like they're in the same room, because the show does sometimes almost like West Wing style, like Aaron Sorkin style walk and talks, where everybody's walking in a different hallway and they're all on their intercoms with each other, and they're shot and cut together in such a way where it really feels like they're having a face-to-face conversation with each other. And sometimes you just flash to like Dargo in the engine room for a second, and he's giving this line to Zahn about like whatever it is, and Chiana's like, we love you, Zahn, and the actors just have to kind of deliver that line to the void of, we're just here in this separate room, not dealing with the immediacy of that situation. And so he's both eking out performances that feel proximate and immediate, and also shooting the scenes in a way where it feels like they're in the same space. So that, I think, is really, really cool. And I think my favorite sequence, directorially speaking, was in at the beginning of the second episode, where the two separate halves of the Moya crew are like planning what they're going to do. And it's cut together in a way where they're clearly coming up with the exact same plan.
Right.
It's really well written. Great idea, and executed perfectly. It was so smooth. Like, you get what's going on right away, and it speaks to the characters, like who's talking, who's agreeing with each other, while also still conveying this information of what's going to be happening. So really inventive and awesome sequence.
Yeah, Tony Till's putting in work. I can't even process how much this show has like improved directorially over time. Like that kind of scene cutting back and forth feels very confident and tight in a way that a lot of the early parts of the show did not. And I think, it's showing that like season three, we're hitting new potential in terms of how we can tell stories and how we can frame things and use the whole cast in these scenes in really clear-headed and good ways. Can you tell that I'm trying not to say the interesting anymore? Can ya? There's a good line where someone said, how long do we have? And then Niala said, maybe an hour, not more. And I said, oh, the rest of the episode. Every time someone asks how much time do we have on the show, it's always just the equivalent of like until the end of the episode. That's all you have to say. But for her to say less than an hour means like, 20 minutes. That's how long.
Let's see. I have some other things I wanted to talk about. So Niala was cool, and her evil, not her evilness, but her turn and self-interest was interesting. Was rad. I don't know, man. They're all empty shits. But I guess my question, or the thing I was kind of asking myself, was like, didn't we know this was going to happen? Like, at what point does it become boring when you introduce aliens and then they're evil?
Right, exactly. It's a good way to look at it. It gets a little bit tiring for them to keep trying to convince you in one episode that we're going to like kill a crew member, and then in the next episode we're going to be like, nope, turns out the people who seemed level-headed are actually just pure purely against us. It is just it's a well that the show keeps coming back to that I feel like they could
Especially since the one that we just saw with the weird religious storm shit had that same device.
Yeah, like literally last episode, we had this problem, and it feels like you can get away from that. You can do so much more with these characters, and you don't have to. You're allowed to keep morally gray people morally gray. You don't have to be like, no. You don't have to feel the viewer don't have to feel confused because they're just
and it's not even necessarily that Niala was completely evil because she had her reasons. I don't know. It's just I sure hope that I think they're getting better at finding the kind of like story of the week. Thing. I guess this is a story of 2 weeks, but they're getting better at figuring out what a small Farscape story looks like. It's just if it always takes the form of like, we meet an alien, the alien seems cool, they're not cool, then that could get very tiring.
It's also a big reason why I don't remember a lot about the second episode other than the notes I took, because it just feels like it's a lot of Niala being like, we got them, we're gonna stop, our plan is in action now, we're gonna take over, we've tricked them. Just it's like, no, I know the crew isn't incompetent, don't try and convince me that you like outsmarted us, because like they pretty quickly figure out her
by the
whole
way
plot.
Something I totally forgot to talk about in the first episode, translator microbes.
I wrote that down. They had that whole scene where they put the DRD, like stabbed one of them in the foot, and they were like, yeah, go translator microbes, and then they were able to talk, and that communication saved the day.
But hey, someone was gonna get shot. Remember that those exist. That's cool.
The part where I had the translator microbes moment of the week, I think it was in part two, but Aaron said something like, oh, the proximity tier Arn magical, I don't know what the word was, but she says like some weird word relating to Niala's ship, like its properties. And Niala goes, yeah, that is the correct pronunciation of the
like
word.
How
you're using
can, how can
and you're like,
you
wait,
use it wrong?
Yeah, and how do you, how could she have pronounced
right.
it? Like, what did it translate
right.
to?
Yeah.
And what
you
would have been a bad
You
we
can't
did it.
Pronounce
this time I picked up on
wrong.
It. Yay! When you have translator microbes.
Unless you're actively trying to say
the language
a foreign
as, like,
word, but then...
like tattoo? Yeah.
But then how would you ever know to try to pronounce a foreign word if you always hear foreign words in your own tongue? Whatever. Listen, it's all a little... Do you think this would be a good entry point into the show, this pair of episodes?
Huh. Well, we talked about the first episode relies on a lot of continuity stuff, so maybe not. But I think the questions that are being asked in this, like, you can explain a lot of that stuff pretty easily, like the Harvey stuff. I think maybe. I think it really does reward you for picking up on all the references, but maybe you could just start with this episode and kind of, like, understand the vibe. Because everyone has really good iconic moments in this episode.
I just found myself recognizing a few instances of exposition-y dialogue that pointed to an intention on the part of the writers to make these episodes accessible to new viewers, which I think is always something that you should keep an eye on at the beginning of a season of television. It's usually much more apparent in the first episode of a season than in the third or the fourth. But in this season, that first episode relied very heavily on your familiarity with the finale of the previous season. Like, it was in the same place, a lot of the same
it's literally a part three.
And then Sons and Lovers, is that what the next one was called?
Dealt
with the ramifications of relationships that were established again at the end of that season. So this episode feels like we're finally on the other side of all of that stuff, and we are dipping our toes into the new normal.
Into the
real characters like Rigel saying, like, we all used to be prisoners. So, okay, there's that. You know where everyone's coming from.
We know where everyone's
coming
from.
You kill a major character in Zahn and you introduce Jewel. So there's that shift of cast. John has this exchange with Niala where she's like, yeah, if my ship blows up, then the beacon is going to be on your ship. And then he's like, we're going to have another set of bad guys chasing us across the universe.
I was totally like, did they just set up season three with that line?
I don't know,
like,
if that's actually going to bear fruit, but...
I was going to ask you that question, after you mentioned you finished.
There's also an interest. This episode seems to express an interest in setting the stakes for the season to come. In that respect, and also in the respect of John talking to Harvey and being like, is Scorpius still alive? What's he up to?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then even the the end of this second episode sets the tone of the kinds of things that we're going to be struggling with in this season, with the Harvey line that we talked about of why is it, whatever the line is, what it,
why do the innocent people always die for the ambitious people?
And that kind of that feels like a lesson or an idea that we're going to keep returning to over the course of the season. Yeah. So
right, that can be the theme of
I don't know, something to think about. I'm always interested in that idea of people jumping onto a show, because you can argue for the sake of completion that you should start from the beginning. But there's also the case to be made that at the beginning of a show, the writers have no way of envisioning it in its entirety and seeing exactly how things are going to be shaped. So when does the artistic artifact really begin in a show? Like, when is the rightful beginning of a piece that can be considered as a long piece? If you think of a show's incipient episodes as kind of trying to parse out what it is that a part of the artistic project? Is that like an irreplaceable aspect of the whole, or is it something that's interesting and that can be approached on its own right, but ultimately is not necessary to the work or, you know, the opus that you eventually arrive at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm going to posit a theory, or just a sort of point. This show takes place on a living ship, a ship that has goals and problems and flaws and agency. And I also think that one of my favorite things about Farscape, the whole show, is that it feels like a living, breathing show with a beginning, middle, and an end, and a goal that it's trying to get to, but it's also never feels like this is exactly where we're going to be from now on. Because it's the kind of show, like, it is this idealized version of sci-fi television where Star Trek is, after like two or three episodes, is essentially what it's going to be for the whole show. There are cast changes, there are, you know, budget changes, but it is still about a crew of people trying to navigate a future version of the world that we live in. And Farscape, I feel like it has one or two key themes, you know, getting home, discovering what you want out of life, and trying to figure out like how you want to interact with other people, and like what are other people's lives worth to you, and what is your own life worth to you. But it is never just like, oh, this is just a standard Farscape episode, and that's because it's so subversive. And it so much relies on you, like, knowing how these types of episodes would normally go. If Farscape was generic, then we could say, like, oh, around season two, it hits its stride, and then it's just that forever. And, you know, people say that about season three, but I feel like this show ever settles. And I really love that about it. It never feels like I'm just comfortable with what it is. Like, they can just kill off a character in the third of four seasons and just be like, she's gone now, even though she's been here since episode one. And you're just going to deal with that. And it's so unique in that way. And I think that's why it's formed has such a cult following, is because it never settled. And you could argue that the crew also never settles, and get into that whole thing. But that's for a long article that I'm not going to be the person to write. But somebody should probably write
that. Yeah, I appreciate that point. I think it's something that I think about a lot, is the idea of, is there such a thing as a jumping on point, really?
Yeah. It's I'm going to keep thinking about it. I'm going to keep seeing whenever we have different episodes, like, does this work? Does this work? Because season three is clearly like, we think that the writers have hit their stride, but like, is this plot-wise easy enough to understand?
And hey, seizure warning.
You could just watch the show from here.
Yeah.
In this episode?
There's just the part where they're just like lights the whole time.
There's a whole lot of flashing lights in this episode. I had to like look away. And in the first one, and like the dimension, when he's looking through the dimension kaleidoscope, I'm going to keep calling it that because I don't know what it has, what its name is.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's lots of flashing. I know there's like a legal limit to how fast that stuff can go on television before it's illegal to like make it. It'll kill people. It'll Pokemon episode people. But it'll Porygon the shit out
of you. So Jewel is just healthy, I guess. That's something that we're gonna investigate and find out about, because she was in one of those like pods where she should have died when she came out.
Yeah, she's alive now. And then that's the question of her character, is why did you survive?
Right. And so it kind of calls into question the moral absolutism of the diagnosis. Like, they would all die if they weren't in stasis.
Yeah. She didn't die when she got out of stasis, so wait a minute.
Right.
Maybe you are full of the shits. I really want to... I kind of did a little bit of legwork while watching this episode, because this piece of trivia that I found is not in the Illustrated Companion or the Farscape Encyclopedia Project. This is like Alan found this. Around the part in the episode that we're talking about, Crichton says, all right, one Adam 12, everybody. And I was like, that's a really weird thing for him to say. And I did some Googling, and it's referring to the television show Adam 12, which is from the creators of Dragnet. I believe it was popular in the 70s or 80s. and it was these two cops in I don't know where, but it's a cop mm-hmm. show. It's, you know, a cop police procedural. Adam Whoa. 12 stars Kent McCord is one of the two cops. Kent McCord is John Creighton's dad. Someone, that is the most intentional ass line I've ever heard. I'm like, no one, that is absolutely what you guys were going for. That's weird and kind of cool. But, you know, you could totally excuse that as another, like, John Creighton pop culture reference, just whatever. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was funny to point out that it was also starring the actor.
I don't really have anything else on this episode. I don't know if you have more notes.
I have a little bit. There was a great intercut scene where Zahn was doing some really intense praying while Aaron was looking for functioning areas of the ship. Because it's this great contrast of, like, Zahn is doing a very traditional, like, Abrahamic religion type of prayer, which is like, everything's hard for me. Please tell, please prove to me that there's hope out there. And please prove to me that things are going to be all right. And at the same exact time, as all this music is swelling, Aaron is constantly walking into rooms and going, nope, nothing here. Nothing is alive here. Everything in this room is dead. Next room, everything's dead. And then finally she gets the pilot and she says, oh, there's enough air in here for him to breathe. He's going to be fine. And everyone has that sigh of relief. And then Zahn says, thank you. She like whispers thank you to the goddess. And you're like, fuck. That says more about religion than like a lot of the stuff with Zahn's arc has. Really, really something. There's another incredible Harvey scene where they are they're like parked on the highway in like a truck or something. And Harvey is in John's dad's like wedding suit or something, or in like the tuxedo that he wore. It's another one of those good scenes. We kind of talked about those in the last discussion. So I was going to ask you, are the green aliens, did I understand that right? Are they going to be chasing us for now?
Yeah, what a question.
What a question. You know, I'd be interested in that. I'd like this idea that it's kind of like doing the same thing season one, episode one did, where it's like, we just started and we already have a thing that's going to last forever. Like, John goes through the wormhole and then shit, now crazy is going to follow me forever.
They certainly put a lot of effort into defining these aliens visually.
Yeah.
And also visually in a way where there's ways of differentiating them. Like, you can make them different colors and their heads different shapes. They have a thing that they do, which is they shoot stuff. They have a style or an outlook that's distinct from the peacekeepers, because the peacekeepers are much more military and these people seem much more scientific and intellectual and a little cleaner. They have this kind of crystalline aesthetic to them.
Yeah, a lot of their technology is like white and tube-like and very so sterile.
All that to say that if they did become regular, there's enough to chew on that I think that would be okay, but I have no idea.
I'd be into it. I'm also just curious to see what the arc of this season is going to be other than the stuff we already know, and it feels like we've now dipped our toe into the water, so that is an exciting potential future. And then Zahn dies, and the scene right after is actually really great, where Rigel goes into Pilot's chambers, and I watched this scene like 5 times over, and I took a picture of it because it's so cute and nice. Rigel walks in on Pilot, and Pilot says, "You are being nicer to me than you've ever been before." And Rigel says, "I like you, Pilot. I like you a lot," or something like that. And it was like, in my head, the part of me that likes to make the fantasy characters kiss was like, oh my god, Rigel was setting up a Rigel Pilot relationship
there.
He was flirting with Pilot, but then there's also just the part of me, like the clash against that part of my personality that says Rigel is just desperate to like be nice again because he feels like he spent so much of his time being an asshole, and now that someone's died, he's kind of like reconsidering himself and trying to like cure those wounds,
those self-inflicted.
And also it reminds
wounds.
You that everybody just likes, hey, oh wow, look what you did, look at this thing you made. he's trying to redeem himself, I think, maybe in that scene, at least with Pilot. And it also just reminds you that everybody likes Pilot and they want Pilot to like them back because, you know, he is part of the ship that takes them everywhere, so it's not in your best interest to make Pilot hate you. So that was a hot scene. And then Chiana and Jewel have one more scene of kind of sassiness where they're kind of being mean to each other, and then Chiana's like, I just lost one of my Jewel's like, oh, the nerve. And then Chiana's like, I just lost one of my best friends. I am nothing but nerves right now. And then she's like, if you want someone to like you, you should invest in a mirror. And you're like, oh, shit. Chiana dropping bombs? Chiana dropping straight fire? That was a good line. Aaron is with Stark, and they have that whole little moment. Aaron says she expected him to be more upset, but he says Zahn was not resistant. Oh, and then that's like that great line where he says, I can pull up, it's in the memorable quotes. Imagine being so at peace, so certain that what was next was better. She does not want us upset. She wants us to carry on her spirit, positive and hopeful. Aaron says, and you can do that? Stark says, not always. I would appreciate you hovering then. Like, Stark is clearly, again, trying to, like, accept his flaws and be like, I need people to help me be the person that Zahn wanted me to be. So I think that Zahn's death, while sad and unfortunate, is going to propel a lot of really good development for all of the Team Moya. And then the final scene is Crichton sitting alone in Zahn's quarters, and he's like, oh man, maybe I shouldn't be so obsessed with wormholes. And he's watching a Three Stooges clip, and then it cuts to the last scene of the episode, which is him with Harvey. And Harvey asks him, while they're at the drive-thru, why is it always the gentle ones who pay the price for someone else's ambition? And just Crichton's like, those words are so painfully true. You know what? And he just says, fucking. He throws his beer bottle. Yeah. And that's the episode. It's that's a really good way to end an episode, I will say. But for us to end an episode of Escape Chats, we first it's have to kind talk of, about the background.
So I'll grab it in just a moment. It kind of recalls for me a common trope of season one, which is that John would always go to Zahn to talk out and process things new in his life and glean a lesson from the episode. And now this is the kind of dark mirror of that, where instead of reaching out to somebody to find a kind of serene and positive message, John is receding into himself and communicating with Harvey to find the kind of like seedy, dark, unlikable but true thing that's going on.
Everyone that's good in your life is going to die.
So that's just an interesting parallel of a trope that Farscape has engaging in for a while. Background.
A lot of growth.
Huge growth. Background info. Christ does not appear in this episode.
I guess they do need to keep mentioning that because he was credited in the credits.
But whatever. We can just take that as him being credited for pilot, I guess. I don't, whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's why this is in the background info. Claudia Black suggested the Yoda from Dagobah line, since she felt Aaron would have picked up on some of Crichton's pop culture references. Cool. The scene where Chiana and Dargo look for the invisible Pathfinder was done live on set with dry ice and laser beams. Interesting. Both Virginia Hay and Gigi Edgley had trouble shooting their final scene together and had to have their makeup redone due to their genuine tears.
Aw.
Guy Gross used his score to reflect Zahn's religious beliefs and inner peace in her farewell speech. The original plan was to have Zahn planted in a planet's soil and return for her in a few episodes, but that didn't work out.
Yeah.
The Three Stooges film Crichton watches is Disorder in the Court, one of about a half dozen Stooge shorts from the 1930s that have fallen into the public domain, meaning the footage could be used without the production team needing to pay royalties or licensing fees. They got clearance to use the clip on the morning the drive-in scene was to be shot. That's funny. Crichton's calculation that the wormhole is no more than 40 years from Earth is based upon the theory that television broadcasts on Earth, particularly those directed to broadcast satellites, continue outward from Earth at the speed of light and may therefore be received by spacecraft or planets within range. So he was like, I can go through. It's only 40 light years away. But like, what are you going to do for 40 years? Yeah,
and you're gonna age 40 years.
You don't even have any food.
I didn't even consider that. Wow, I would like to think that his ship can travel.
Yeah, but not faster than the speed of light, baby. That's not physics.
You don't think so? It's a sci-fi show.
Yeah, but he's using an Earth thing. Yeah,
the Farscape one. Well, I thought the implication was he would use the wormhole to go through it and skip all.
I think the point is the other end of the wormhole is 40 years away from Earth.
Yes. Oh, the end point at the other side is it's still 40. Well, that's useless. Yeah. What are you doing?
Virginia Hay becomes the only day one cast member to leave the series as a regular for the.
Thank you, Virginia Hay, for your service.
What she did do was always great stuff. For the first time since his debut in Crackers Don't Matter, Harvey is shown wearing Earth clothes familiar to Crichton. The tux.
Wait, when was he wearing Earth clothes? Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. Sorry, I'm reading. I'm going to read this out loud, actually. This is a quote from the Farscape Illustrated Companion. We had so many fake deaths that we wanted to appreciate the gravity of the moment. Gigi Edgley recalls the emotion of the moment spilling over. All of the truthful stuff was coming through, she says, and we both started crying. There was blue and white makeup, then dark blue and light blue. We were like two little ice creams melting into one. They had to stop the scene. So it's touching. And I really, it matters a lot to me that the actors on the show liked each other enough that they were genuinely emotionally affected by one of them leaving. And speaking of leaving, I think it's time to leave this episode of Escape Chats. But this ship has one more stop to make on its way to Credits Land. And before we can get to to Credits Land, we need to pass by a planet Netflix.
Oh, baby. Season 3, episode 5. Dot, dot, dot.
different destinations. Crichton and the crew are pulled back in time during a siege between peacekeepers and the Vennik, and every action is changing the course of history.
Whoa, I am so excited for a
season
time travel episode.
Yeah, season
and
3,
and we've never seen the
Vennik
before, so they're new. Eaten.
With their transport pod damaged, the crew must land on a Leviathan ship with a peacekeeper control collar. So there you go.
Ooh.
That's next week. Who knows?
Who knows what'll happen next time on Farscape? Probably people have watched the show before, but we don't. Because we haven't watched it before. And that's HS. That's the premise of the show that you're listening to right now. Let's do some quick housekeeping before we head off. You can email us questions, comments, and feedback at scapechats@gmail.com. We also have a Reddit thread, which you can find every week at reddit.com/r/farscape. You can tweet at scapechats for replies from me about the episodes. And you can get updates on when new episodes get published. You can rate us on iTunes and Stitcher if you're into that sort of thing. It helps us get the word out. We have a Tumblr. It's scapechats.tumblr.com. And you can find me personally at twitter.com/AlanIbrahim, spelled AlanIbrahim. I don't really tweet a lot these days because it's the summer and I like to get work done, but I will follow you back and we can talk about Farscape or whatever you want if you follow
me.
Oh,
I'm John, what about on you? Twitter at JustaFluke, JustaFluke. I never use it, but same deal. If you want to be my buddy, I'll be your buddy. That's just
and then
what's
we'll
going to happen.
What? Buddy times. You know what, John?
Hey,
Thank you, you know,
I kind of like this. I'd love to do it again sometime.
Me
well,
too.
By
I
this,
think we
I mean, I
kind
of like recording 25 episodes of a podcast, and I'd love to do it again.
Yes. Oh, Magellan. Oh, stretch
get,
him out.
Get the
get
legs
all. That's all stretched. And let's, with the legs all, let's get the frill out of here.